and unable to cure him. "Ah," said the miracle worker, "I have seen a good deal of this sort of spirits when I was in Ireland. They are watery spirits, who bring on cold shivering and excite an overflow of aqueous humors in our poor bodies." Then, addressing the man, he said, "Evil spirit, who hast quitted thy dwelling in the waters to come and afflict this miserable body, I command thee to quit thy new abode and to return to thine ancient habitation." This said, the sick man was ordered to withdraw, and another was brought forward in his place. This newcomer said he was tormented by the melancholy vapors. In fact, he looked like a hypochondriac, one of those persons diseased in imagination, and who but too often become so in reality. "Aerial spirit," said the Irishman, "return, I command thee, into the air. Exercise thy natural vocation of raising tempests, and do not excite any more wind in this sad, unlucky body." This man was immediately turned away to make room for a third patient, who, in the Irishman's opinion, was only tormented by a little bit of a sprite, who could not understand his command for an instant. He pretended that he recognized this sprite by some marks which were invisible to the company, to whom he turned with a smile and said, "This sort of spirit does not often do much harm, and is always very diverting." To hear him talk, one would have imagined that he knew all about spirits, their names, their rank, their numbers, their employment, and all the functions they were destined to. And he boasted of being much better acquainted with the intrigues of demons than he was with the affairs of men. You can hardly imagine what a reputation he gained in a short time. Catholics and Protestants visited him from every part, all believing that power from heaven was in his hands. After relating a rather equivocal adventure of a husband and wife who implored Greatrax to cast out the devil of dissension which had crept in between them, Saint Evremond thus sums up the effect he produced on the popular mind. So great was the confidence in him that the blind fancied they saw the light which they did not see, the deaf imagined that they heard, the lame that they walked straight, and the paralytic that they had recovered the use of their limbs. An idea of health made the sick forget for a while their maladies, and imagination, which was not less active in those merely drawn by curiosity than in the sick, gave a false view to the one class from the desire of seeing, as it operated a false cure on the other from the strong desire of being healed. Such was the power of the Irishman over the mind, and such was the influence of the mind upon the body. Nothing was spoken of in London but his prodigies, and these prodigies were supported by such great authorities that the bewildered multitude believed them almost without examination, while more enlightened people did not dare to reject them from their own knowledge. The public opinion, timid and enslaved, respected this imperious and apparently well-authenticated error. Those who saw through the delusion kept their opinion to themselves, knowing how useless it was to declare their disbelief to a people filled with prejudice and admiration. About the same time that Valentine Greatrax was thus magnetizing the people of London, an Italian enthusiast named Francisco Bagnone was performing the same tricks in Italy, and with as great success. He had only to touch weak women with his hands, or sometimes, for the sake of working more effectively upon their fanaticism, with a relic to make them fall into fits and manifest all the symptoms of magnetism. Besides these, several learned men in different parts of Europe directed their attention to the study of the magnet, believing that it might be rendered efficacious in many diseases. Von Helmont, in particular, published a work on the effects of magnetism on the human frame, and Balthasar Gracian, a Spaniard, rendered himself famous for the boldness of his views on the subject. "The magnet," said the latter, "attracts iron. Iron is found everywhere. Everything, therefore, is under the influence of magnetism. It is only a modification of the general principle which establishes harmony or foments divisions among men. It is the same agent that gives rise to sympathy, antipathy, and the passions." Baptista Porta, who, in the whimsical genealogy of the weapon salve given by Parson Foster in his attack upon Dr. Afflutibus, is mentioned as one of its fathers, had also great faith in the efficacy of the magnet and operated upon the imagination of his patients in a manner which was then considered so extraordinary that he was accused of being a magician. and prohibited from practicing by the court of Rome. Among others who distinguished themselves by their faith in magnetism, Sebastian Wirdig and William Maxwell claim a special notice. Wirdig was professor of medicine at the University of Rostock in Mecklenburg and wrote a treatise called The New Medicine of the Spirits, which he presented to the Royal Society of London. An edition of this work was printed in 1673, in which the author maintained that a magnetic influence took place not only between the celestial and terrestrial bodies, but between all living things. The whole world, he said, was under the influence of magnetism. Life was preserved by magnetism. Death was the consequence of magnetism. Maxwell, the other enthusiast, was an admiring disciple of Paracelsus, and boasted that he had irradiated the obscurity in which too many of the wonder-working recipes of that great philosopher were enveloped. His works were printed at Frankfurt in 1679. It would seem from the following passage that he was aware of the great influence of imagination, as well as in the production as in the cure of diseases. "If you wish to work prodigies," says he, "abstract from the materiality of beings, increase the sum of spirituality in bodies, rouse the spirit from its slumbers. Unless you do one or other of these things, unless you can bind the idea, you can never perform anything good or great." Here, in fact, lies the whole secret of magnetism and all delusions of a similar kind. Increase the spirituality, rouse the spirit from its slumbers, or in other words, work upon the imagination, induce belief and blind confidence, and you may do anything. This passage, which is quoted with approbation by Monsieur Dupotet in a work, as strongly corroborative of the theory now advanced by the animal magnetists, is just the reverse. If they believe they can work all their wonders by the means so dimly shadowed forth by Maxwell, what becomes of the universal fluid pervading all nature, and which they pretend to pour into weak and diseased bodies from the tips of their fingers? Early in the 18th century, the attention of Europe was directed to a very remarkable instance of fanaticism, which has been claimed by the animal magnetists as a proof of their science. The convulsionaries of Saint-Médard, as they were called, assembled in great numbers round the tomb of their favorite saint, the Jansenist priest Paris, and taught one another how to fall into convulsions. They believed that Saint Paris would cure all their infirmities, and the number of hysterical women and weak-minded persons of all descriptions that flocked to the tomb from far and near was so great as daily to block up all the avenues leading to it. Working themselves up into a pitch of excitement, they went off one after the other into fits, while some of them, still in apparent possession of all their faculties, voluntarily exposed themselves to sufferings which on ordinary occasions would have been sufficient to deprive them of life. The scenes that occurred were a scandal to civilization and to religion, a strange mixture of obscenity, absurdity, and superstition. While some were praying on bended knees at the shrine of St. Paris, others were shrieking and making the most hideous noises. The women especially exerted themselves. On one side of the chapel there might be seen a score of them, all in convulsions, while at another as many more, excited to a sort of frenzy, yielded themselves up to gross indecencies. Some of them took an insane delight in being beaten and trampled upon. One in particular, according to Montaigre, whose account we quote, was so enraptured with this ill usage that nothing but the hardest blows would satisfy her. While a fellow of Herculean strength was beating her with all his might with a heavy bar of iron, she kept continually urging him to renewed exertion. The harder he struck, the better she liked it, exclaiming all the while, "Well done, brother, well done! Oh, how pleasant it is! What good you are doing me! Courage, my brother, courage! Strike harder still!" Another of these fanatics had, if possible, a still greater love for a beating. Carré de Montgeron, who relates the circumstance, was unable to satisfy her with 60 blows of a large sledgehammer. He afterwards used the same weapon with the same degree of strength, for the sake of experiment, and succeeded in battering a hole in a stone wall at the 25th stroke. Another woman named Sonnet laid herself down on a red-hot brazier without flinching and acquired for herself the nickname of the Salamander. While others, desirous of a more illustrious martyrdom, attempted to crucify themselves. Monsieur Deleuze, in his Critical History of Animal Magnetism, attempts to prove that this fanatical frenzy was produced by magnetism, and that these mad enthusiasts magnetized each other without being aware of it. As well might he insist that the fanaticism which tempts the Hindu bigot to keep his arms stretched in a horizontal position till the sinews wither, or his fingers closed upon his palms till the nails grow out the backs of his hands, is also an effect of magnetism. For a period of 60 or 70 years, magnetism was almost wholly confined to Germany. Men of sense and learning devoted their attention to the properties of the lodestone. And one Father Hell, a Jesuit and professor of astronomy at the University of Vienna, rendered himself famous by his magnetic cures. About the year 1771 or 1772, he invented steel plates of a peculiar form, which he applied to the naked body as a cure for several diseases. In the year 1774, he communicated his system to Anthony Mesmer. The latter improved upon the ideas of Father Hell, constructed a new theory of his own, and became the founder of animal magnetism. It has been the fashion among the enemies of the new delusions to decry Mesmer as an unprincipled adventurer, while his disciples have extolled him to the skies as a regenerator of the human race. In nearly the same words as the Rosicrucians applied to their founders, he has been called the discoverer of the secret which brings man into more intimate connection with his Creator, the deliverer of the soul from the debasing trammels of the flesh. The man who enables us to set time at defiance and conquer the obstructions of space. A careful sifting of his pretensions and examination of the evidence brought forward to sustain them will soon show which opinion is the more correct, that the writer of these pages considers him in the light of a man who, deluding himself, was the means of deluding others, may be inferred from his finding a place in these volumes, and figuring among the Flamels, the Agrippas, the Bories, the Burmans, and the Cagliostros. He was born in May 1734 at Meersburg in Swabia and studied medicine at the University of Vienna. He took his degrees in 1766 and chose the influence of the planets on the human body as the subject of his inaugural dissertation. Having treated the matter quite in the style of the old astrological physicians, he was exposed to some ridicule both then and afterwards. Even at this early period, some faint ideas of his great theory were germinating in his mind. He maintained in his dissertation that the sun, moon, and fixed stars mutually affect each other in their orbits, that they cause and direct in our earth a flux and reflux, not only in the sea, but in the atmosphere, and affect in a similar manner all organized bodies through the medium of a subtile and mobile fluid, which pervades the universe and associates all things together in mutual intercourse and harmony. This influence, he said, was particularly exercised on the nervous system, and produced two states which he called intention and remission, which seemed to him to account for the different periodical revolutions observable in several maladies. When, in afterlife, he met with Father Hell, he was confirmed by that person's observations in the truth of many of his own ideas. Having caused Hell to make him some magnetic plates, he determined to try experiments with them himself for his further satisfaction. He tried accordingly and was astonished at his success. The faith of their wearers operated wonders with the metallic plates. Mesmer made due reports to Father Hell of all he had done, and the latter published them as the results of his own happy invention. And speaking of Mesmer as a physician whom he had employed to work under him, Mesmer took offense at being thus treated, considering himself a far greater personage than Father Hell. He exclaimed the invention as his own, accused Hell of a breach of confidence, and stigmatized him as a mean person, anxious to turn the discoveries of others to his own account. Hell replied, and a very pretty quarrel was the result, which afforded small talk for months to the literati of Vienna. Hell ultimately gained the victory. Mesmer, nothing daunted, continued to promulgate his views, till he stumbled at last upon the animal theory. One of his patients was a young lady named Oesterlin, who suffered under a convulsive malady. Her attacks were periodical and attended by a rush of blood to the head, followed by delirium and syncope. These symptoms he soon succeeded in reducing under his system of planetary influence, and imagined he could foretell the periods of accession and remission. Having thus accounted satisfactorily to himself for the origin of the disease, the idea struck him that he could operate a certain cure if he could ascertain beyond doubt what he had long believed, that there existed between the bodies which compose our globe an action equally reciprocal and similar to that of the heavenly bodies, by means of which he could imitate artificially the periodical revolutions of the flux and reflux before mentioned. He soon convinced himself that this action did exist. When trying the metallic plates of Father Hell, he thought their efficacy depended on their form. But he found afterwards that he could produce the same effects without using them at all, merely by passing his hands downwards towards the feet of the patient, even when at a considerable distance. This completed the theory of Mesmer. He wrote an account of his discovery to all the learned societies of Europe, soliciting their investigation. The Academy of Sciences at Berlin was the only one that answered him, and their answer was anything but favorable to his system or flattering to himself. Still, he was not discouraged. He maintained to all who would listen to him that the magnetic matter or fluid pervaded all the universe, that every human body contained it, and could communicate the superabundance of it to another by an exertion of the will. Writing to a friend from Vienna, he said, "I have observed that the magnetic is almost the same thing as the electric fluid, and that it may be propagated in the same manner by means of intermediate bodies. Steel is not the only substance adapted to this purpose. I have rendered paper, bread, wool, silk, stones, leather, glass, wood, men, and dogs, in short, everything I touched, magnetic to such a degree that these substances produced the same effects as the lodestone on diseased persons. I have charged jars with magnetic matter in the same way as is done with electricity." Mesmer did not long find his residence at Vienna as agreeable as he wished. His pretensions were looked upon with contempt or indifference, and the case of Mademoiselle Oesterlin brought him less fame than notoriety. He determined to change his sphere of action, and traveled into Swabia and Switzerland. In the latter country he met with the celebrated Father Gastner, who, like Valentine Greatrax, amused himself by casting out devils and healing the sick by merely laying hands upon them. At his approach, delicate girls fell into convulsions, and hypochondriacs fancied themselves cured. His house was daily besieged by the lame, the blind, and the hysteric. Mesmer at once acknowledged the efficacy of his cures and declared that they were the obvious result of his own newly discovered power of magnetism. A few of the father's patients were forthwith subjected to the manipulations of Mesmer, and the same symptoms were induced. He then tried his hand upon some paupers in the hospitals of Bern and Zurich, and succeeded, according to his own account, but no other persons, in curing an ophthalmia and a gutta serena. With memorials of these achievements, he returned to Vienna in the hope of silencing his enemies, or at least forcing them to respect his newly acquired reputation and to examine his system more attentively. His second appearance in that capital was not more auspicious than the first. He undertook to cure a Mademoiselle Paradis, who was quite blind and subject to convulsions. He magnetized her several times and then declared that she was cured. At least, if she was not, it was her fault and not his. An eminent oculist of that day named Bart went to visit her and declared that she was as blind as ever, while her family said she was as much subject to convulsions as before. Mesmer persisted that she was cured. Like the French philosopher, he would not allow facts to interfere with his theory. An enthusiastic philosopher, of whose name we are not informed, had constructed a very satisfactory theory on some subject or other, and was not a little proud of it. "But the facts, my dear fellow," said his friend, "the facts do not agree with your theory." "Don't they?" replied the philosopher, shrugging his shoulders. "Then, tant pis pour les faits. So much the worse for the facts." He declared that there was a conspiracy against him, and that Mademoiselle Paradis, at the instigation of her family, feigned blindness in order to injure his reputation. The consequences of this pretended cure taught Mesmer that Vienna was not the sphere for him. Paris, the idle, the debauched, the pleasure-hunting, the novelty-loving, was the scene for a philosopher like him, and thither he repaired accordingly. He arrived at Paris in 1778 and began modestly by making himself and his theory known to the principal physicians. At first his encouragement was but slight. He found people more inclined to laugh at than to patronize him. But he was a man who had great confidence in himself and of a perseverance which no difficulties could overcome. He hired a sumptuous apartment which he opened to all comers who chose to make trial of the new power of nature. Monsieur Deslon, a physician of great reputation, became a convert, and from that time animal magnetism, or as some called it, mesmerism, became the fashion in Paris. The women were quite enthusiastic about it, and their admiring tattle wafted its fame through every grade of society. Mesmer was the rage, and high and low, rich and poor, credulous and unbelieving, all hastened to convince themselves of the power of this mighty magician, who made such magnificent promises. Mesmer, who knew as well as any man living the influence of the imagination, determined that on that score nothing should be wanting to heighten the effect of the magnetic charm. In all Paris there was not a house so charmingly furnished as Monsieur Mesmer's. Richly stained glass shed a dim religious light on his spacious saloons, which were almost covered with mirrors. Orange blossoms scented all the air of his corridors. Incense of the most expensive kinds burned in antique vases on his chimney-pieces. Aeolian harps sighed melodious music from distant chambers, while sometimes a sweet female voice from above or below stole softly upon the mysterious silence that was kept in the house and insisted upon from all visitors. "Was ever anything so delightful?" cried all the Mrs. Wititterlys of Paris, as they thronged to his house in search of pleasant excitement. "So wonderful," said the pseudo-philosophers, who would believe anything if it were the fashion. "So amusing," said the worn-out debauchees, who had drained the cup of sensuality to its dregs, and who longed to see lovely women in convulsions with the hope that they might gain some new emotions from the sight. The following was the mode of operation. In the center of the saloon was placed an oval vessel, about 4 feet in its longest diameter and 1 foot deep. In these were laid a number of wine bottles filled with magnetized water, well corked up and disposed in radii, with their necks outwards. Water was then poured into the vessel so as just to cover the bottles, and filings of iron were thrown in occasionally to heighten the magnetic effect. The vessel was then covered with an iron cover, pierced through with many holes, and was called the baquet. From each hole issued a long, movable rod of iron, which the patients were to apply to such parts of their bodies as were afflicted. Around this baquet the patients were directed to sit, holding each other by the hand and pressing their knees together as closely as possible, to facilitate the passage of the magnetic fluid from one to the other. Then came in the assistant magnetizers, generally strong, handsome young men, to pour into the patient from their fingertips fresh streams of the wondrous fluid. They embraced the patient between the knees, rubbed them gently down the spine and the course of the nerves, using gentle pressure upon the breasts of the ladies, and staring them out of countenance to magnetize them by the eye. All this time the most rigorous silence was maintained, with the exception of a few wild notes on the harmonica or the pianoforte, or the melodious voice of a hidden opera singer swelling softly at long intervals. Gradually the cheeks of the ladies began to glow, their imaginations to become inflamed, and off they went one after the other into convulsive fits. Some of them sobbed and tore their hair, others laughed till the tears ran from their eyes, while others shrieked and screamed and yelled till they became insensible altogether. This was the crisis of the delirium. In the midst of it, the chief actor made his appearance, waving his wand like Prospero to work new wonders. Dressed in a long robe of lilac-colored silk richly embroidered with gold flowers, bearing in his hand a white magnetic rod, and with a look of dignity which would have sat well on an Eastern caliph, he marched with solemn strides into the room. He awed the still sensible by his eye, and the violence of their symptoms diminished. He stroked the insensible with his hands upon the eyebrows and down the spine, traced figures upon their breast and abdomen with his long white wand, and they were restored to consciousness. They became calm, acknowledged his power, and said they felt streams of cold or burning vapor passing through their frames, according as he waved his wand or his fingers before them. "It is impossible," says Monsieur Dupotet, "to conceive the sensation which Mesmer's experiments created in Paris. No theological controversy in the early ages of the Catholic Church was ever conducted with greater bitterness." His adversaries denied the discovery, some calling him a quack, others a fool, and others again, like the Abbé Fiard, a man who had sold himself to the devil. His friends were as extravagant in their praise as his foes were in their censure. Paris was inundated with pamphlets upon the subject, as many defending as attacking the doctrine. At court, the queen expressed herself in favor of it, and nothing else was to be heard of in society. By the advice of Monsieur Deslon, Mesmer challenged an examination of his doctrine by the Faculty of Medicine. He proposed to select 24 patients, 12 of whom he would treat magnetically, leaving the other 12 to be treated by the faculty according to the old and approved methods. He also stipulated that, to prevent disputes, the government should nominate certain persons who were not physicians to be present at the experiments, and that the object of the inquiry should be not how these effects were produced, but whether they were really efficacious in the cure of any disease. The faculty objected to limit the inquiry in this manner, and the proposition fell to the ground. Mesmer now wrote to Marie Antoinette, with the view of securing her influence in obtaining for him the protection of government. He wished to have a chateau and its lands given to him with a handsome yearly income, that he might be enabled to continue his experiments at leisure, untroubled by the persecution of his enemies. He hinted the duty of governments to support men of science, and expressed his fear that if he met no more encouragement, he should be compelled to carry his great discovery to some other land more willing to appreciate him. "In the eyes of your majesty," said he, 400,000 or 500,000 francs applied to a good purpose are of no account. The welfare and happiness of your people are everything. My discovery ought to be received and rewarded with a munificence worthy of the monarch to whom I shall attach myself." The government at last offered him a pension of 20,000 francs and the cross of the Order of St. Michael, if he had made any discovery in medicine and would communicate it to physicians nominated by the king. The latter part of the proposition was not agreeable to Mesmer. He feared the unfavorable report of the king's physicians, and, breaking off the negotiation, spoke of his disregard of money and his wish to have his discovery at once recognized by the government. He then retired to Spa in a fit of disgust, upon pretense of drinking the waters for the benefit of his health. After he had left Paris, the Faculty of Medicine called upon Monsieur Deslon, for the third and last time, to renounce the doctrine of animal magnetism or be expelled from their body. Monsieur Deslon, so far from doing this, declared that he had discovered new secrets, and solicited further examination. A royal commission of the Faculty of Medicine was, in consequence, appointed on the 12th of March, 1784, seconded by another commission of the Académie des Sciences, to investigate the phenomena and report upon them. The first commission was composed of the principal physicians of Paris, while among the eminent men comprised in the latter were Benjamin Franklin, Lavoisier, and Bailly, the historian of astronomy. Mesmer was formally invited to appear before this body, but absented himself from day to day upon one pretense or another. Monsieur Deslon was more honest because he thoroughly believed in the phenomena, which it is to be questioned if Mesmer ever did, and regularly attended the sittings and performed experiments. Bailly has thus described the scenes of which he was a witness in the course of this investigation. The sick persons, arranged in great numbers and in several rows around the baquet, receive the magnetism by all these means, by the iron rods which convey it to them from the baquet, by the cords wound round their bodies, by the connection of the thumb which conveys to them the magnetism of their neighbors, and by the sounds of a pianoforte or of an agreeable voice, diffusing the magnetism in the air. The patients were also directly magnetized by means of the finger and wand of the magnetizer moved slowly before their faces, above or behind their heads, and on the diseased parts, always observing the direction of the holes. The magnetizer acts by fixing his eyes upon them. But above all, they are magnetized by the application of his hands and the pressure of his fingers, on the hypochondries and on the regions of the abdomen, an application often continued for a long time, sometimes for several hours. Meanwhile, the patients in their different conditions present a very varied picture. Some are calm, tranquil, and experience no effect. Others cough, spit, feel slight pains, local or general heat, and have sweatings. Others, again, are agitated and tormented with convulsions. These convulsions are remarkable in regard to the number affected with them, to their duration and force. As soon as one begins to be convulsed, several others are affected. The commissioners have observed some of these convulsions last more than 3 hours. They are accompanied by expectorations of a muddy, viscous water, brought away by violent efforts. Sometimes streaks of blood have been observed in this fluid. These convulsions are characterized by the precipitous, involuntary motion of all the limbs and of the whole body, by the contraction of the throat, by the leaping motions of the hypochondria and the epigastrium, by the dimness and wandering of the eyes, by piercing shrieks, tears, sobbing, and immoderate laughter. They are preceded or followed by a state of languor or reverie, a kind of depression and sometimes drowsiness. The smallest sudden noise occasions a shuddering, and it was remarked that the change of measure in the airs played on the pianoforte had a great influence on the patients. A quicker motion, a livelier melody, agitated them more and renewed the vivacity of their convulsions. Nothing is more astonishing than the spectacle of these convulsions. One who has not seen them can form no idea of them. The spectator is as much astonished at the profound repose of one portion of the patients as at the agitation of the rest, at the various accidents which are repeated and at the sympathies which are exhibited. Some of the patients may be seen devoting their attention exclusively to one another, rushing towards each other with open arms, smiling, soothing, and manifesting every symptom of attachment and affection. All are under the power of the magnetizer. It matters not in what state of drowsiness they may be. The sound of his voice, a look, a motion of his hand, brings them out of it. Among the patients in convulsions, there are always observed a great many women and very few men. These experiments lasted for about 5 months. They had hardly commenced before Mesmer, alarmed at the loss both of fame and profit, determined to return to Paris. Some patients of rank and fortune, enthusiastic believers in his doctrine, had followed him to Spa. One of them, named Bergasse, proposed to open a subscription for him of 100 shares, at 100 louis each, on condition that he would disclose his secret to the subscribers, who were to be permitted to make whatever use they pleased of it. Mesmer readily embraced the proposal, and such was the infatuation that the subscription was not only filled in a few days, but exceeded by no less a sum than 140,000 francs. With this fortune he returned to Paris and recommenced his experiments, while the Royal Commission continued theirs. His admiring pupils, who had paid him so handsomely for his instructions, spread his fame over the country and established in all the principal towns of France societies of harmony for trying experiments and curing all diseases by means of magnetism. Some of these societies were a scandal to morality, being joined by profligate men of depraved appetites, who took a disgusting delight in witnessing young girls in convulsions. Many of the pretended magnetizers were asserted at the time to be notorious libertines, who took that opportunity of gratifying their passions. At last the commissioners published their report, which was drawn up by the illustrious and unfortunate Bailly. For clearness of reasoning and strict impartiality, it has never been surpassed. After detailing the various experiments made and their results, they came to the conclusion that the only proof advanced in support of animal magnetism was the effects it produced on the human body, that those effects could be produced without passes or other magnetic manipulations, that all these manipulations and passes and ceremonies never produce any effect at all if employed without the patient's knowledge, and that therefore imagination did, and animal magnetism did not, account for the phenomena. This report was the ruin of Mesmer's reputation in France. He quitted Paris shortly after, with the 340,000 francs which had been subscribed by his admirers, and retired to his own country, where he died in 1815 at the advanced age of 81. But the seeds he had sown fructified of themselves, nourished and brought to maturity by the kindly warmth of popular credulity. Imitators sprang up in France, Germany, and England, more extravagant than their master and claiming powers for the new science which its founder had never dreamt of. Among others, Cagliostro made good use of the delusion in extending his claims to be considered a master of the occult sciences. But he made no discoveries worthy to be compared with these of the Marquis de Puységur and the Chevalier Barbarin, honest men who began by deceiving themselves before they deceived others. The Marquis de Puységur, the owner of a considerable estate at Beaugency, was one of those who had entered into the subscription for Mesmer. After that individual had quitted France, he retired to Beaugency with his brother to try animal magnetism upon his tenants and cure the country people of all manner of diseases. He was a man of great simplicity and much benevolence, and not only magnetized but fed the sick that flocked around him. In all the neighborhood, and indeed within a circumference of 20 miles, he was looked upon as endowed with a power almost divine. His great discovery, as he called it, was made by chance. One day he had magnetized his gardener, and observing him to fall into a deep sleep, it occurred to him that he would address a question to him, as he would have done to a natural somnambulist. He did so, and the man replied with much clearness and precision. Monsieur de Puységur was agreeably surprised. He continued his experiments and found that in this state of magnetic somnambulism, the soul of the sleeper was enlarged and brought into more intimate communion with all nature, and more especially with him, Monsieur de Puységur. He found that all further manipulations were unnecessary, that without speaking or making any sign, he could convey his will to the patient, that he could, in fact, converse with him, soul to soul, without the employment of any physical operation whatever. Simultaneously with this marvelous discovery, he made another, which reflects equal credit upon his understanding. Like Valentine Greatraks, he found it hard to magnetize all that came, that he had not even time to take the repose and relaxation which were necessary for his health. In this emergency, he hit upon a clever expedient. He had heard Mesmer say that he could magnetize bits of wood. Why should he not be able to magnetize a whole tree? It was no sooner thought than done. There was a large elm on the village green at Beaugency, under which the peasant girls used to dance on festive occasions, and the old men to sit drinking their vin du pays on the fine summer evenings. Monsieur de Puységur proceeded to this tree and magnetized it, by first touching it with his hands and then retiring a few steps from it, all the while directing streams of the magnetic fluid from the branches toward the trunk and from the trunk toward the root. This done, he caused circular seats to be erected round it and cords suspended from it in all directions. When the patients had seated themselves, they twisted the cords round the diseased parts of their bodies and held one another firmly by their thumbs to form a direct channel of communication for the passage of the fluid. Monsieur de Puységur had now two hobbies, the man with the enlarged soul and the magnetic elm. The infatuation of himself and his patients cannot be better expressed than in his own words. Writing to his brother on the 17th of May, 1784, he says, "If you do not come, my dear friend, you will not see my extraordinary man, for his health is now almost quite restored. I continue to make use of the happy power for which I am indebted to Monsieur Mesmer. Every day I bless his name, for I am very useful and produce many salutary effects on all the sick poor in the neighborhood. They flock around my tree. There were more than 130 of them this morning. It is the best baquet possible. Not a leaf of it but communicates health. All feel more or less the good effects of it. You will be delighted to see the charming picture of humanity which this presents. I have only one regret. It is that I cannot touch all who come. But my magnetized man, my intelligence, sets me at ease. He teaches me what conduct I should adopt. According to him, it is not at all necessary that I should touch everyone. A look, a gesture, even a wish is sufficient. And it is one of the most ignorant peasants of the country that teaches me this. When he is in a crisis, I know of nothing more profound, more prudent, more clear-sighted, clairvoyant, than he is. In another letter describing his first experiment with the magnetic tree, he says, "Yesterday evening I brought my first patient to it. As soon as I had put the cord round him, he gazed at the tree, and with an air of astonishment which I cannot describe, exclaimed, 'What is it that I see there?' His head then sunk down, and he fell into a perfect fit of somnambulism. At the end of an hour I took him home to his house again, when I restored him to his senses. Several men and women came to tell him what he had been doing. He maintained it was not true, that weak as he was and scarcely able to walk, it would have been scarcely possible for him to have gone downstairs and walked to the tree. Today I have repeated the experiment on him, and with the same success. I own to you that my head turns round with pleasure to think of the good I do. Madame de Puysegur, the friends she has with her, my servants, and in fact all who are near me, feel an amazement mingled with admiration which cannot be described, but they do not experience the half of my sensations. Without my tree, which gives me rest and which will give me still more, I should be in a state of agitation, inconsistent, I believe, with my health. I exist too much, if I may be allowed to use the expression." In another letter he descants still more poetically upon his gardener with the enlarged soul. He says, "It is from this simple man, this tall and stout rustic, 23 years of age, enfeebled by disease, or rather by sorrow, and therefore the more predisposed to be affected by any great natural agent. It is from this man, I repeat, that I derive instruction and knowledge. When in the magnetic state he is no longer a peasant who can hardly utter a single sentence. He is a being to describe whom I cannot find a name. I need not speak. I have only to think before him when he instantly understands and answers me. Should anybody come into the room, he sees him, if I desire it, but not else, and addresses him and says what I wish to say, not indeed exactly as I dictate to him, but as truth requires. When he wants to add more than I deem it prudent strangers should hear, I stop the flow of his ideas and of his conversation in the middle of a word, and give it quite a different turn." Among other persons attracted to Busancy by the report of these extraordinary occurrences was Monsieur Cloquet, the receiver of finance. His appetite for the marvelous being somewhat insatiable, he readily believed all that was told him by Monsieur de Puysegur. He also has left a record of what he saw and what he credited, which throws a still clearer light upon the progress of the delusion. He says that the patients he saw in the magnetic state had an appearance of deep sleep, during which all the physical faculties were suspended, to the advantage of the intellectual faculties. The eyes of the patients were closed, the sense of hearing was abolished, and they awoke only at the voice of their magnetizer. If anyone touched a patient during a crisis, or even the chair on which he was seated, says Monsieur Cloquet, it would cause him much pain and suffering and throw him into convulsions. During the crisis they possess an extraordinary and supernatural power by which, on touching a patient presented to them, they can feel what part of his body is diseased, even by merely passing their hand over the clothes. Another singularity was that these sleepers who could thus discover diseases, see into the interior of other men's stomachs and point out remedies, remembered absolutely nothing after the magnetizer thought proper to disenchant them. The time that elapsed between their entering the crisis and their coming out of it was obliterated. Not only had the magnetizer the power of making himself heard by the somnambulists, but he could make them follow him by merely pointing his finger at them from a distance, though they had their eyes the whole time completely closed. Such was animal magnetism under the auspices of the Marquis de Puységur. While he was exhibiting these phenomena around his elm tree, a magnetizer of another class appeared in Lyon in the person of the Chevalier de Barberin. This gentleman thought the effort of the will, without any of the paraphernalia of wands or baquets, was sufficient to throw patients into the magnetic sleep. He tried it and succeeded. By sitting at the bedside of his patients and praying that they might be magnetized, they went off into a state very similar to that of the persons who fell under the notice of Monsieur de Puységur. In the course of time, a very considerable number of magnetizers, acknowledging Barberin for their model, and called after him Barberinists, appeared in different parts, and were believed to have effected some remarkable cures. In Sweden and Germany, this sect of fanatics increased rapidly, and were called spiritualists, to distinguish them from the followers of Monsieur de Puységur, who were called experimentalists. They maintained that all the effects of animal magnetism, which Mesmer believed to be producible by a magnetic fluid dispersed through nature, were produced by the mere effort of one human soul acting upon another, that when a connection had once been established between a magnetizer and his patient, the former could communicate his influence to the latter from any distance, even hundreds of miles, by the will. One of them thus described the blessed state of a magnetic patient. In such a man, animal instinct ascends to the highest degree admissible in this world. The clairvoyant is then a pure animal, without any admixture of matter. His observations are those of a spirit. He is similar to God. His eye penetrates all the secrets of nature. When his attention is fixed on any of the objects of this world, on his disease, his death, his well-beloved, his friends, his relations, his enemies, in spirit he sees them acting. He penetrates into the causes and the consequences of their actions. He becomes a physician, a prophet, a divine. Let us now see what progress these mysteries made in England. In the year 1788, Dr. Menoduc, who had been a pupil first of Mesmer and afterwards of Deslon, arrived in Bristol, and gave public lectures upon magnetism. His success was quite extraordinary. People of rank and fortune hastened from London to Bristol to be magnetized, or to place themselves under his tuition. Dr. George Winter, in his History of Animal Magnetism, gives the following list of them. They amounted to 127, among whom there were one duke, one duchess, one marchioness, two countesses, one earl, one baron, three baronesses, one bishop, five right honorable gentlemen and ladies, two baronets, seven members of parliament, one clergyman, two physicians, seven surgeons, besides 92 gentlemen and ladies of respectability. He afterwards established himself in London, where he performed with equal success. He began by publishing proposals to the ladies for the formation of a Hygeian Society. In this paper, he vaunted highly the curative effects of animal magnetism and took great credit to himself for being the first person to introduce it into England, and thus concluded, "As this method of cure is not confined to sex or college education, and the fair sex being in general the most sympathizing part of the creation and most immediately concerned in the health and care of its offspring, I think myself bound in gratitude to you, ladies, for the partiality you have shown me in midwifery, to contribute, as far as lies in my power, to render you additionally useful and valuable to the community. With this view, I propose forming my Hygeian Society, to be incorporated with that of Paris. As soon as 20 ladies have given in their names, the day shall be appointed for the first meeting at my house, when they are to pay 15 guineas, which will include the whole expense." Hannah Moore, in a letter addressed to Horace Walpole in September 1788, speaks of the demoniacal mummeries of Dr. Menoduc, and says he was in a fair way of gaining £100,000 by them, as Mesmer had done by his exhibitions in Paris. So much curiosity was excited by the subject that about the same time a man named Holloway gave a course of lectures on animal magnetism in London, at the rate of 5 guineas for each pupil, and realized a considerable fortune. Lowderburg, the painter, and his wife followed the same profitable trade, and such was the infatuation of the people to be witnesses of their strange manipulations that at times upwards of 3,000 persons crowded around their house at Hammersmith, unable to gain admission, the tickets sold at prices varying from 1 to 3 guineas. Lowderburg performed his cures by the touch after the manner of Valentine Greatracks, and finally pretended to a divine mission. An account of his miracles, as they were called, was published in 1789, entitled A List of New Cures Performed by Mr. and Mrs. de Lowderburg of Hammersmith Terrace, Without Medicine, by a Lover of the Lamb of God, dedicated to His Grace the Archbishop of Canterbury. This Lover of the Lamb of God was a half-crazy old woman named Mary Pratt, who conceived for Mr. and Mrs. de Lowderburg a veneration which almost prompted her to worship them. She chose for the motto of her pamphlet a verse in the 13th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles, "Behold, ye despisers, and wonder and perish, for I will work a work in your days which ye shall not believe, though a man declare it unto you." Attempting to give a religious character to the cures of the painter, she thought a woman was the proper person to make them known, since the apostle had declared that a man should not be able to conquer the incredulity of the people. She stated that from Christmas 1788 to July 1789, de Lowderburg and his wife had cured 2,000 people, having been made proper recipients to receive divine manuductions, which heavenly and divine influx coming from the Radix God, His Divine Majesty had most graciously bestowed upon them to diffuse healing to all, be they deaf, dumb, blind, lame, or halt. In her dedication to the Archbishop of Canterbury, she implored him to compose a new form of prayer to be used in all churches and chapels, that nothing might impede this inestimable gift from having its due course. She further entreated all the magistrates and men of authority in the land to wait on Mr. and Mrs. de Lowderburg, to consult with them on the immediate erection of a large hospital, with a pool of Bethesda attached to it. All the magnetizers were scandalized at the preposterous jabber of this old woman, and de Lowderburg appears to have left London to avoid her, continuing, however, in conjunction with his wife, the fantastic tricks which had turned the brain of this poor fanatic and deluded many others who pretended to more sense than she had. From this period until 1798, magnetism excited little or no attention in England. An attempt to revive the belief in it was made in that year, but it was in the shape of mineral rather than of animal magnetism. One Benjamin Douglas Perkins, an American, practicing as a surgeon in Leicester Square, invented and took out a patent for the celebrated metallic tractors. He pretended that these tractors, which were 2 small pieces of metal strongly magnetized, something resembling the steel plates which were first brought into notice by Father Hell, would cure gout, rheumatism, palsy, and, in fact, almost every disease the human frame was subject to, if applied externally to the afflicted part, and moved about gently, touching the surface only. The most wonderful stories soon obtained general circulation, and the press groaned with pamphlets, all vaunting the curative effects of the tractors, which were sold at 5 guineas the pair. Perkins gained money rapidly. Gouty subjects forgot their pains in the presence of this new remedy. The rheumatism fled at its approach, and toothache, which is often cured by the mere sight of a dentist, vanished before Perkins and his marvelous steel plates. The Benevolent Society of Friends, of whose body he was a member, warmly patronized the invention. Desirous that the poor, who could not afford to pay Mr. Perkins 5 guineas, or even 5 shillings for his tractors, should also share in the benefits of that sublime discovery, they subscribed a large sum and built an hospital, called the Perkinian Institution, in which all comers might be magnetized free of cost. In the course of a few months, they were in very general use, and their lucky inventor in possession of £5,000. Dr. Haygarth, an eminent physician at Bath, recollecting the influence of imagination in the cure of disease, hit upon an expedient to try the real value of the tractors. Perkins's cures were too well established to be doubted, and Dr. Haygarth, without gainsaying them, quietly but in the face of numerous witnesses, exposed the delusion under which people labored with respect to the curative medium. He suggested to Dr. Faulkner that they should make wooden tractors, paint them to resemble the steel ones, and see if the very same effects would not be produced. 5 patients were chosen from the hospital in Bath upon whom to operate. 4 of them suffered severely from chronic rheumatism in the ankle, knee, wrist, and hip, and the 5th had been afflicted for several months with the gout. On the day appointed for the experiments, Dr. Haygarth and his friends assembled at the hospital and with much solemnity brought forth the fictitious tractors. 4 out of the 5 patients said their pains were immediately relieved, and 3 of them said they were not only relieved, but very much benefited. 1 felt his knee warmer and said he could walk across the room. He tried and succeeded, although on the previous day he had not been able to stir. The gouty man felt his pains diminish rapidly and was quite easy for 9 hours, until he went to bed when the twitching began again. On the following day, the real tractors were applied to all the patients, when they described their symptoms in nearly the same terms. To make still more sure, the experiment was tried in the Bristol infirmary a few weeks afterwards, on a man who had a rheumatic affection in the shoulder, so severe as to incapacitate him from lifting his hand from his knee. The fictitious tractors were brought and applied to the afflicted part, one of the physicians, to add solemnity to the scene, drawing a stopwatch from his pocket to calculate the time exactly, while another, with a pen in his hand, sat down to write the change of symptoms from minute to minute as they occurred. In less than 4 minutes, the man felt so much relieved that he lifted his hand several inches without any pain in the shoulder. An account of these matters was published by Dr. Haygarth in a small volume entitled Of the Imagination as a Cause and Cure of Disorders, Exemplified by Fictitious Tractors. The exposure was a coup de grace to the system of Mr. Perkins. His friends and patrons, still unwilling to confess that they had been deceived, tried the tractors upon sheep, cows, and horses, alleging that the animals received benefit from the metallic plates but none at all from the wooden ones. But they found nobody to believe them. The Perkinian institution fell into neglect, and Perkins made his exit from England, carrying with him about £10,000, to soothe his declining years in the good city of Pennsylvania. Thus was magnetism laughed out of England for a time. In France, the Revolution left men no leisure for studying it. The Société de l'Harmonie of Strasbourg and other great towns lingered for a while, till sterner matters occupying men's attention, they were one after the other abandoned, both by pupils and professors. The system, thus driven from the first 2 nations of Europe, took refuge among the dreamy philosophers of Germany. There the wonders of the magnetic sleep grew more and more wonderful every day. The patients acquired the gift of prophecy. Their vision extended over all the surface of the globe. They could hear and see with their toes and fingers, and read unknown languages, and understand them, too, by merely having the book placed on their stomachs. Ignorant peasants, when once entranced by the grand mesmeric fluid, could spout philosophy diviner than Plato ever wrote, descant upon the mysteries of the mind with more eloquence and truth than the profoundest metaphysicians the world ever saw, and solve knotty points of divinity with as much ease as waking men could undo their shoe buckles. During the first 12 years of the present century, little was heard of animal magnetism in any country of Europe. Even the Germans forgot their airy fancies, recalled to the knowledge of this everyday world by the roar of Napoleon's cannon and the fall of the establishment of kingdoms. During this period, a cloud of obscurity hung over the science, which was not dispersed until Monsieur Deleuze published in 1813 his Histoire critique du magnétisme animal. This work gave a new impulse to the half-forgotten fancy. Newspapers, pamphlets, and books again waged war upon each other on the question of its truth or falsehood. and many eminent men in the profession of medicine recommenced inquiry with an earnest design to discover the truth. The assertions made in the celebrated treatise of Deleuze are thus summed up. There is a fluid continually escaping from the human body, and forming an atmosphere around us, which, as it has no determined current, produces no sensible effects on surrounding individuals. It is, however, capable of being directed by the will, and when so directed, is sent forth in currents with a force corresponding to the energy we possess. Its motion is similar to that of the rays from burning bodies. It possesses different qualities in different individuals. It is capable of a high degree of concentration and exists also in trees. The will of the magnetizer, guided by a motion of the hand several times repeated in the same direction, can fill a tree with this fluid. Most persons, when this fluid is poured into them from the body and by the will of the magnetizer, feel a sensation of heat or cold when he passes his hand before them, without even touching them. Some persons, when sufficiently charged with this fluid, fall into a state of somnambulism or magnetic ecstasy. And when in this state, they see the fluid encircling the magnetizer like a halo of light and issuing in luminous streams from his mouth and nostrils, his head and hands, possessing a very agreeable smell and communicating a particular taste to food and water. One would think that these notions were quite enough to be insisted upon by any physician who wished to be considered sane, but they form only a small portion of the wondrous things related by Monsieur Deleuze. He further said, when magnetism produces somnambulism, the person who is in this state acquires a prodigious extension of all his faculties. Several of his external organs, especially those of sight and hearing, become inactive, but the sensations which depend upon them take place internally. Seeing and hearing are carried on by the magnetic fluid, which transmits the impressions immediately and without the intervention of any nerves or organs directly to the brain. Thus the somnambulist, though his eyes and ears are closed, not only sees and hears, but sees and hears much better than he does when awake. In all things he feels the will of the magnetizer, although that will not be expressed. He sees into the interior of his own body, and the most secret organization of the bodies of all those who may be put en rapport, or in magnetic connection with him. Most commonly, he only sees those parts which are diseased and disordered, and intuitively prescribes a remedy for them. He has prophetic visions and sensations, which are generally true, but sometimes erroneous. He expresses himself with astonishing eloquence and facility. He is not free from vanity. He becomes a more perfect being of his own accord for a certain time, if guided wisely by the magnetizer, but wanders if he is ill-directed. According to Monsieur Deleuze, any person could become a magnetizer and produce these effects by conforming to the following conditions and acting upon the following rules. Forget for a while all your knowledge of physics and metaphysics. Remove from your mind all objections that may occur. Imagine that it is in your power to take the malady in hand and throw it on one side. Never reason for 6 weeks after you have commenced the study. Have an active desire to do good, a firm belief in the power of magnetism, and an entire confidence in employing it. In short, repel all doubts, desire success, and act with simplicity and attention. That is to say, be very credulous, be very persevering, reject all past experience, and do not listen to reason, and you are a magnetizer after Monsieur Deleuze's own heart. Having brought yourself into this edifying state, remove from the patient all persons who might be troublesome to you. Keep with you only the necessary witnesses, a single person if need be. Desire them not to occupy themselves in any way with the processes you employ and the effects which result from them, but to join with you in the desire of doing good to your patient. Arrange yourself so as neither to be too hot nor too cold, and in such a manner that nothing may obstruct the freedom of your motions, and take precautions to prevent interruption during the sitting. Make your patient then sit as commodiously as possible and place yourself opposite to him on a seat a little more elevated, in such a manner that his knees may be betwixt yours, and your feet at the side of his. First, request him to resign himself, to think of nothing, not to perplex himself by examining the effects which may be produced, to banish all fear, to surrender himself to hope, and not to be disturbed or discouraged if the action of magnetism should cause in him momentary pains. After having collected yourself, take his thumbs between your fingers in such a way that the internal part of your thumbs may be in contact with the internal part of his, and then fix your eyes upon him. You must remain from 2 to 5 minutes in this situation, or until you feel an equal heat between your thumbs and his. This done, you will withdraw your hands, removing them to the right and left, and at the same time turning them till their internal surface be outwards, and you will raise them to the height of the head. You will now place them upon the two shoulders, and let them remain there about a minute. Afterwards, drawing them gently along the arms to the extremities of the fingers, touching very slightly as you go. You will renew this pass 5 or 6 times, always turning your hands, and removing them a little from the body before you lift them. You will then place them above the head, and after holding them there for an instant, lower them, passing them before the face at the distance of 1 or 2 inches, down to the pit of the stomach. There you will stop them 2 minutes also, putting your thumbs upon the pit of the stomach and the rest of your fingers below the ribs. You will then descend slowly along the body to the knees, or rather, if you can do so without deranging yourself, to the extremity of the feet. You will repeat the same processes several times during the remainder of the sitting. You will also occasionally approach your patient, so as to place your hands behind his shoulders in order to descend slowly along the spine of the back and the thighs, down to the knees or the feet. After the first passes, you may dispense with putting your hands upon the head, and may make the subsequent passes upon the arms, beginning at the shoulders, and upon the body, beginning at the stomach. Such was the process of magnetizing recommended by Deleuze. That delicate, fanciful, and nervous woman, when subjected to it, should have worked themselves into convulsions, will be readily believed by the sturdiest opponent of animal magnetism. To sit in a constrained posture, be stared out of countenance by a fellow who enclosed her knees between his while he made passes upon different parts of her body, was quite enough to throw any weak woman into a fit, especially if she were predisposed to hysteria and believed in the efficacy of the treatment. It is just as evident that those of stronger minds and healthier bodies should be sent to sleep by the process. That these effects have been produced by these means, there are thousands of instances to show. But are they testimony in favor of animal magnetism? Do they prove the existence of the magnetic fluid? It needs neither magnetism nor ghost from the grave to tell us that silence, monotony, and long recumbency in one position must produce sleep, or that excitement, imitation, and a strong imagination acting upon a weak body will bring on convulsions. Monsieur Deleuze's book produced quite a sensation in France. The study was resumed with redoubled vigor. In the following year, a journal was established devoted exclusively to the science under the title of Annales du Magnétisme Animal, and shortly afterwards appeared the Bibliothèque du Magnétisme Animal, and many others. About the same time, the Abbé Faria, the man of wonders, began to magnetize, and the belief being that he had more of the mesmeric fluid about him and a stronger will than most men, he was very successful in his treatment. His experiments afford a convincing proof that imagination can operate all, and the supposed fluid none, of the results so confidently claimed as evidence of the new science. He placed his patients in an armchair, told them to shut their eyes, and then in a loud, commanding voice pronounced the single word, sleep. He used no manipulations whatever, had no baquet or conductor of the fluid, but he nevertheless succeeded in causing sleep in hundreds of patients. He boasted of having in his time produced 5,000 somnambulists by this method. It was often necessary to repeat the command 3 or 4 times, and if the patient still remained awake, the abbé got out of the difficulty by dismissing him from the chair and declaring that he was incapable of being acted on. And it should be especially remarked that the magnetizers do not lay claim to universal efficacy for their fluid. The strong and the healthy cannot be magnetized. The incredulous cannot be magnetized. Those who reason upon it cannot be magnetized. Those who firmly believe in it can be magnetized. The weak in body can be magnetized, and the weak in mind can be magnetized. And lest for some cause or other individuals of the latter classes should resist the magnetic charm, the apostles of the science declare that there are times when even they cannot be acted upon. The presence of one scorner or unbeliever may weaken the potency of the fluid and destroy its efficacy. In Monsieur Deleuze's instructions to a magnetizer, he expressly says, "Never magnetize before inquisitive persons." Here we conclude the subject, as it would serve no good purpose to extend to greater length the history of animal magnetism, especially at a time when many phenomena, the reality of which it is impossible to dispute, are daily occurring to startle and perplex the most learned, impartial, and truth-loving of mankind. Enough, however, has been stated to show that if there be some truth in magnetism, there has been much error, misconception, and exaggeration. Taking its history from the commencement, it can hardly be said to have been without its uses. To quote the words of Bailly in 1784, magnetism has not been altogether unavailing to the philosophy which condemns it. It is an additional fact to record among the errors of the human mind, and a great experiment on the strength of the imagination. Over that vast inquiry of the influence of mind over matter, an inquiry which the embodied intellect of mankind will never be able to fathom completely, it will at least have thrown a feeble and imperfect light. It will have afforded an additional proof of the strength of the unconquerable will and the weakness of matter as compared with it. Another illustration of the words of the inspired psalmist that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. Influence of Politics and Religion on the Hair and Beard. Speak with respect and honor both of the beard and the beard's owner. Hudibras. The famous declaration of St. Paul, that long hair was a shame unto a man, has been made the pretext for many singular enactments, both of civil and ecclesiastical governments. The fashion of the hair and the cut of the beard were state questions in France and England from the establishment of Christianity until the 15th century. We find, too, that in much earlier times men were not permitted to do as they liked with their own hair. Alexander the Great thought that the beards of the soldiery afforded convenient handles for the enemy to lay hold of, preparatory to cutting off their heads. And, with a view of depriving them of this advantage, he ordered the whole of his army to be closely shaven. His notions of courtesy towards an enemy were quite different from those entertained by the North American Indians, and amongst whom it is held a point of honor to allow one chivalrous lock to grow, that the foe, in taking the scalp, may have something to catch hold of. At one time, long hair was the symbol of sovereignty in Europe. We learn from Gregory of Tours that, among the successors of Clovis, it was the exclusive privilege of the royal family to have their hair long and curled. The nobles, equal to kings in power, would not show any inferiority in this respect, and wore not only their hair but their beards of an enormous length. This fashion lasted, with but slight changes, till the time of Louis the Debonair, but his successors, up to Hugh Capet, wore their hair short by way of distinction. Even the serfs had set all regulation at defiance and allowed their locks and beards to grow. At the time of the invasion of England by William the Conqueror, the Normans wore their hair very short. Harold, in his progress towards Hastings, sent forward spies to view the strength and number of the enemy. They reported, among other things, on their return, that the host did almost seem to be priests, because they had all their face and both their lips shaven. The fashion among the English at the time was to wear the hair long upon the head and the upper lip, but to shave the chin. When the haughty victors had divided the broad lands of the Saxon thanes and franklins among them, when tyranny of every kind was employed to make the English feel that they were indeed a subdued and broken nation, the latter encouraged the growth of their hair, that they might resemble as little as possible their cropped and shaven masters. This fashion was exceedingly displeasing to the clergy, and prevailed to a considerable extent in France and Germany. Towards the end of the 11th century, it was decreed by the Pope, and zealously supported by the ecclesiastical authorities all over Europe, that such persons as wore long hair should be excommunicated while living and not be prayed for when dead. William of Malmesbury relates that the famous St. Wulstan, Bishop of Worcester, was peculiarly indignant whenever he saw a man with long hair. He declaimed against the practice as one highly immoral, criminal, and beastly. He continually carried a small knife in his pocket, and whenever anybody offending in this respect knelt before him to receive his blessing, he would whip it out slyly and cut off a handful, and then, throwing it in his face, tell him to cut off all the rest or he would go to hell. But fashion, which at times it is possible to move with a wisp, stands firm against a lever, and men preferred to run the risk of damnation to parting with the superfluity of their hair. In the time of Henry I, Anselm, Archbishop of Canterbury, found it necessary to republish the famous decree of excommunication and outlawry against the offenders. But as the court itself had begun to patronize curls, the fulminations of the church were unavailing. Henry I and his nobles wore their hair in long ringlets down their backs and shoulders, and became a scandalum magnatum in the eyes of the godly. One Serlo, the king's chaplain, was so grieved in spirit at the impiety of his master that he preached a sermon from the well-known text of St. Paul before the assembled court, in which he drew so dreadful a picture of the torments that awaited them in the other world that several of them burst into tears and wrung their hair, as if they would have pulled it out by the roots. Henry himself was observed to weep. The priest, seeing the impression he had made, determined to strike while the iron was hot, and pulling a pair of scissors from his pocket, cut the king's hair in presence of them all. Several of the principal courtiers consented to do the like, and for a short time long hair appeared to be going out of fashion. But the courtiers thought, after the first glow of their penitence had been cooled by reflection, that the clerical Delilah had shorn them of their strength, and in less than 6 months they were as great sinners as ever. Anselm, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had been a monk of Bec in Normandy, and who had signalized himself at Rouen by his fierce opposition to long hair, was still anxious to work a reformation in this matter, but his pertinacity was far from pleasing to the king, who had finally made up his mind to wear ringlets. There were other disputes of a more serious nature between them, so that when the archbishop died, the king was so glad to be rid of him that he allowed the see to remain vacant for 5 years. Still, the cause had other advocates, and every pulpit in the land resounded with anathemas against that disobedient and long-haired generation. But all was of no avail. Stowe, in writing of this period, asserts, on the authority of some more ancient chronicler, that men, forgetting their birth, transformed themselves by the length of their hairs into the semblance of womankind, and that when their hair decayed from age or other causes, they knit about their heads certain rolls and braidings of false hair. At last accident turned the tide of fashion. A knight of the court, who was exceedingly proud of his beauteous locks, dreamed one night that as he lay in bed, the devil sprang upon him and endeavored to choke him with his own hair. He started in a fright and actually found that he had a great quantity of hair in his mouth. Sorely stricken in conscience and looking upon the dream as a warning from heaven, he set about the work of reformation and cut off his luxuriant tresses the same night. The story was soon bruited abroad. Of course, it was made the most of by the clergy, and the knight, being a man of influence and consideration, and the acknowledged leader of the fashion, his example, aided by priestly exhortations, was very generally imitated. Men appeared almost as decent as St. Wulstan himself could have wished, the dream of a dandy having proved more efficacious than the entreaties of a saint. But, as Stowe informs us, scarcely was 1 year past when all that thought themselves courtiers fell into the former vice and contended with women in their long hairs. Henry, the king, appears to have been quite uninfluenced by the dreams of others, for even his own would not induce him a second time to undergo a cropping from priestly shears. It is said that he was much troubled at this time by disagreeable visions. Having offended the church in this and other respects, he could get no sound, refreshing sleep, and used to imagine that he saw all the bishops, abbots, and monks of every degree standing around his bedside, and threatening to belabor him with their pastoral staves. which sight, we are told, so frightened him that he often started naked out of his bed and attacked the phantoms sword in hand. Grimbald, his physician, who, like most of his fraternity at that day, was an ecclesiastic, never hinted that his dreams were the result of a bad digestion, but told him to shave his head, be reconciled to the church, and reform himself with alms and prayer. But he would not take this good advice, and it was not until he had been nearly drowned a year afterwards in a violent storm at sea that he repented of his evil ways, cut his hair short, and paid proper deference to the wishes of the clergy. In France, the thunders of the Vatican with regard to long curly hair were hardly more respected than in England. Louis VII, however, was more obedient than his brother king, and cropped himself as closely as a monk, to the great sorrow of all the gallants of his court. His queen, the gay, haughty, and pleasure-seeking Eleanor of Guienne, never admired him in this trim, and continually reproached him with imitating not only the headdress but the asceticism of the monks. From this cause, a coldness arose between them. The lady proving at last unfaithful to her shaven and indifferent lord, they were divorced, and the kings of France lost the rich provinces of Guienne and Poitou, which were her dowry. She soon after bestowed her hand and her possessions upon Henry, Duke of Normandy, afterwards Henry II of England, and thus gave the English sovereigns that strong footing in France which was for so many centuries the cause of such long and bloody wars between the nations. When the Crusades had drawn all the smart young fellows into Palestine, the clergy did not find it so difficult to convince the staid burghers who remained in Europe of the enormity of long hair. During the absence of Richard, Coeur de Lion, his English subjects not only cut their hair close, but shaved their faces. William Fitzosbert, or Longbeard, the great demagogue of that day, reintroduced among the people who claimed to be of Saxon origin the fashion of long hair. He did this with the view of making them as unlike as possible to the citizens and the Normans. He wore his own beard hanging down to his waist, from whence the name by which he is best known to posterity. The church never showed itself so great an enemy to the beard as to long hair on the head. It generally allowed fashion to take its own course, both with regard to the chin and the upper lip. This fashion varied continually, for we find that in little more than a century after the time of Richard I, when beards were short, that they had again become so long as to be mentioned in the famous epigram made by the Scots, who visited London in 1327, when David, son of Robert Bruce, was married to Joan, the sister of King Edward. This epigram, which was stuck on the church door of St. Peter Stangate, ran as follows: "Long beards heartless, painted hoods witless, gray coats graceless, make England thriftless." When the Emperor Charles V ascended the throne of Spain, he had no beard. It was not to be expected that the obsequious parasites who always surround a monarch could presume to look more virile than their master. Immediately all the courtiers appeared beardless, with the exception of such few grave old men as had outgrown the influence of fashion and who had determined to die bearded as they had lived. Sober people in general saw this revolution with sorrow and alarm, and thought that every manly virtue would be banished with the beard. It became at the time a common saying, "Desde que no hay barba, no hay más alma." We have no longer souls since we have lost our beards. In France also, the beard fell into disrepute after the death of Henry IV, from the mere reason that his successor was too young to have one. Some of the more immediate friends of the great Béarnais, and his minister Sully among the rest, refused to part with their beards, notwithstanding the jeers of the new generation. Who does not remember the division of England into the two great parties of roundheads and cavaliers? In those days, every species of vice and iniquity was thought by the Puritans to lurk in the long curly tresses of the monarchists, while the latter imagined that their opponents were as destitute of wit, of wisdom, and of virtue as they were of hair. A man's locks were the symbol of his creed, both in politics and religion. The more abundant the hair, the more scant the faith, and the balder the head, the more sincere the piety. But among all the instances of the interference of governments with men's hair, the most extraordinary, not only for its daring but for its success, is that of Peter the Great in 1705. By this time, fashion had condemned the beard in every other country in Europe, and with a voice more potent than popes or emperors, had banished it from civilized society. But this only made the Russians cling more fondly to their ancient ornament, as a mark to distinguish them from foreigners whom they hated. Peter, however, resolved that they should be shaven. If he had been a man deeply read in history, he might have hesitated before he attempted so despotic an attack upon the time-hallowed customs and prejudices of his countrymen. But he was not. He did not know or consider the danger of the innovation. He only listened to the promptings of his own indomitable will, and his fiat went forth, that not only the army but all ranks of citizens, from the nobles to the serfs, should shave their beards. A certain time was given that people might get over the first throes of their repugnance, after which every man who chose to retain his beard was to pay a tax of 100 rubles. The priests and the serfs were put on a lower footing and allowed to retain theirs upon payment of a kopeck every time they passed the gate of a city. Great discontent existed in consequence, but the dreadful fate of the Strelitzes was too recent to be forgotten, and thousands who had the will had not the courage to revolt. As is well remarked by a writer in the Encyclopaedia Britannica, they thought it wiser to cut off their beards than to run the risk of incensing a man who would make no scruple in cutting off their heads. Wiser, too, than the popes and bishops of a former age, he did not threaten them with eternal damnation, but made them pay in hard cash the penalty of their disobedience. For many years, a very considerable revenue was collected from this source. The collectors gave in receipt for its payment a small copper coin, struck expressly for the purpose, and called the Borodovaya, or the Bearded. On one side it bore the figure of a nose, mouth, and mustaches, with a long bushy beard, surmounted by the words Deuye Veate, money received, the whole encircled by a wreath and stamped with the Black Eagle of Russia. On the reverse it bore the date of the year. Every man who chose to wear a beard was obliged to produce this receipt on his entry into a town. Those who were refractory and refused to pay the tax were thrown into prison. Since that day, the rulers of modern Europe have endeavored to persuade rather than to force in all matters pertaining to fashion. The Vatican troubles itself no more about beards or ringlets, and men may become hairy as bears, if such is their fancy, without fear of excommunication or deprivation of their political rights. Folly has taken a new start and cultivates the mustache. Even upon this point, governments will not let men alone. Religion as yet has not meddled with it, but perhaps it will, and politics already influence it considerably. Before the Revolution of 1830, neither the French nor Belgian citizens were remarkable for their mustaches. But after that event, there was hardly a shopkeeper, either in Paris or Brussels, whose upper lip did not suddenly become hairy with real or mock mustaches. During a temporary triumph gained by the Dutch soldiers over the citizens of Louvain in October 1830, it became a standing joke against the patriots that they shaved their faces clean immediately, and the wits of the Dutch army asserted that they had gathered mustaches enough from the denuded lips of the Belgians to stuff mattresses for all the sick and wounded in their hospital. The last folly of this kind is still more recent. In the German newspapers of August 1838 appeared an ordinance signed by the King of Bavaria forbidding civilians on any pretense whatever to wear mustaches, and commanding the police and other authorities to arrest and cause to be shaved the offending parties. Strange to say, adds Le Droit, the journal from which this account is taken, mustaches disappeared immediately like leaves from the trees in autumn. Everybody made haste to obey the royal order, and not one person was arrested. The King of Bavaria, a rhymester of some celebrity, has taken a good many poetical licenses in his time. His license in this matter appears neither poetical nor reasonable. It is hoped that he will not take it into his royal head to make his subjects shave theirs. Nothing but that is wanting to complete their degradation. Volume 2. The Crusades. They heard, and up they sprang upon the wing innumerable, as when the potent rod of Amram's son in Egypt's evil day waved round the coast, upcalled a pitchy cloud of locusts, warping on the eastern wind that o'er the realm of impious Pharaoh hung like night, and darkened all the realm of Nile, so numberless were they. All in a moment through the gloom were seen 10,000 banners rising into the air, with orient colors waving. With them rose a forest huge of spears, and thronging helms appeared, and serried shields in thick array, of depth immeasurable. Paradise Lost. Every age has its peculiar folly, some scheme, project, or fantasy into which it plunges,